nothing like that out there.
But it can't. It's not an idea.
Please be seated. Welcome.
The United States Court of International Trade is now in session. The Honorable Clara Kelly, Gary S. Katzman, and Jane A. Rustani presiding before court number 19-00009, Trans-Pacific Steel LLC versus the United States. Will the attorneys please state their names for the record, starting with plaintiff's counsel.
Matthew Dolan with Eric Fox for Trans-Pacific.
This is Russell Summer with Eric Fox, also for Trans-Pacific.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Stephen Tassini, and I represent the United States.
And Ming Yuo, also representing the United States.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, we're ready to start. Steve, we have a time?
Yes, I'm not sure what the council's, what time, but he reserved here.
Okay, so if you could let us know what time you've reserved for rebuttal.
Yes, this is Matt Noll for Trans-Pacific. We would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, Your Honor.
Okay. Okay, does the government want to reserve any time after it speaks for serve rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor, Steve Tassini for the government. We'd like to reserve 5 minutes as well.
Okay, great. Okay, Mr. Nolan, would you like to start?
Yes, sir. Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. Mayor, please support. We are in an unusual situation here with you all. I've never had a court appearance by video before, so this is going to be something new for me and for all of the subjects, so I'll try to speak a little bit slower and try to give time.
Thank you.
We're going to split the argument up a little bit. I will handle the ultra-virus nexus issue and the procedural statutory issue. Mr. Summer is going to handle equal protection and due process. So we'll try to roughly split it up in half, and I would expect the judge or the court will interrupt us and tell us what you wanted to talk about, so we'll go to court on that. Just to start, I'd like to talk about the question that the court raised on the nexus ultra vires, and that is excellent in your mind. Just to sort of read through your question, or just talk about it really quickly, obviously the question comes as to whether the government has failed to establish a nexus for the presidential proclamation, and whether that's required because once the national security threat has been announced and it's relegated to the president's discretion, as long as he's empowered to act in accordance with the procedures of the statute and the power assigned to him. And for starters, we as plaintiffs don't disagree with that statement, Your Honor. Obviously, the court knows better than we do. The statute certainly does commit the adjustment of imports to alleviate national security to the president's discretion, as long as he follows the specific procedural and timing requirements. In this case, the Commerce Department issued a report, and the President agreed that cumulative imports of steel, and I repeat, cumulative imports of steel from a large group of countries presented a national security threat. The President's nexus and its discretionary authority, in our minds, derived from that report. The report did not name a specific country, it named a large group of countries. Therefore, his discretion to act included actions related to addressing that cumulative threat with options to impose either tariffs, quotas, or negotiating agreements with other parties. If the President makes public statements which appear to contradict that national security purpose or rationale, then I think it's open for the court to consider those statements in addition to the actions taken.
What is your best authority for that proposition that we can consider tweets
statements that are perhaps not officially designated as official.
I think, and we'll get into this later in Mr. Semmel's discussion, but I think that the president, when he makes an official statement and he puts it out into the public, he has made a public iteration, which is fair game for review. To say that the president can say some things officially and not say some things unofficially would seem to me to be misconstruing or not taking into account what the president is actually doing, because he can be selective about what he's allowed to talk about or what is officially going to be considered. I think there are instances in the past where the president has made statements, not an executive order, but made iterations that would be used as policy guidance as to his motivations and why he was doing it and taking a certain action. I do think a tweet is fair game in that environment. Now, you know, it is legitimate in our minds for the court to ask whether in fact there is a national security underpinning for an action when that action is taken at a much later date than the norm time period and different from the initial measures imposed, and only with respect to one country, when the report, which he is relying on as the boss of that authority, does not indicate that a specific country should be targeted. The report, in my mind, identifies a whole group of countries or a smaller group of 12 countries that might be subject to a remedy, but does not say anything about an individual country having excessive amounts of influence on the process. Now,
Judge Rustani has a question.
Now, in your brief, you did mention the statement about we're not happy with Turkey right now, or something like that. You had previously mentioned some statement about a pastor. Is that part of this record?
Say again, Your Honor. I didn't quite get it.
You had mentioned a statement about a pastor. Is that part of this record?
Yes, Your Honor. There is a statement about the pastor. The president made a subsequent tweet when the Turkish government was invading, I think it was Syria at the time, and he told the Turkish government that he could put measures back into place to punish Turkey for their actions in a foreign policy sphere if he chose to, and he referred back to the action he took in connection with the pastor as an example of how he could ruin the Turkish economy.
All right.
And
that's part of the evidence you put before the court?
Yes, I think that statement was placed before the court. All right. So, admittedly, this case is about steel, right? I mean, I remember the court at one point discussing that case about peanut butter and whether peanut butter is a national security threat. We're not talking about peanut butter. We are talking about steel. But having received instruction or at least background from the Commerce Department about what the threat was, and the threat was this cumulative threat from a number of countries, then in our mind, his nexus to national security authority is based on that report and the cumulative threat code. And what he did here was go beyond what was in his authority under the statute for purposes of finding a nexus to national security by identifying one single country. Now, I know that history is not on our side on this, and that there's going to be difficulty in the court accepting the idea of interfering with the president's discretion. However, if the court decides that it cannot look behind the president's motives here, then all the more pressure gets put on following the procedural rules in the statute, ensuring that it is fairly and equally administered under the law, and that due process is respected, because otherwise the president has very few breaks on abusing the authority that he would have. And so we're putting more pressure on other aspects of the statute to follow. Any questions on that before I move on?
You can move on.
Yep. All right, thank you very much. And I'd like to move on to the procedural legal arguments. We are obviously in complete agreement with the court's opinion from the motion to dismiss in this case with respect to the procedural rules at play. We do not believe the government has provided any new arguments to the court which would alter the court's views. The government here would like you to conclude that once the president has determined that a national security threat or event exists and requires an action, then any action taken of any duration, whether within the time frame prescribed by the statute or beyond it, is relegated to his discretion without breaks or further procedural requirements. We respectfully disagree. That is not what the law says. It is inconsistent with the reading of Algonquin that specifically states that 232 has clear preconditions for presidential action. It is inconsistent with the 1998 amendments to the law, which added time requirements for action, and it is not what this court ruled on in the AIIF case. It is clear that if the president has unlimited discretion once the words national security are uttered, then the statute has no brakes on president's ability to act, and we are running headlong into the intelligible principle, which must be considered, and of course the court has ruled, and the Augustine court, the court ruled, the intelligible principle does exist in this statute.
I have another question for you. The statute lists factors in 1862D that the president shall consider. When the statute says the president shall consider factors, what are we to do by way of review of that?
I think that the factors that the president reviews are important considerations in deriving his authority. I'm not sure how much the court can get into the factors themselves, because the president isn't required to take an action that is consistent with the factors that are listed in there. He has to review them and consider them. But again, we run back into the issue of discretion, and I'm not sure what you can make of that.
How do we know if they were considered? Do they have to be mentioned in the report?
It would be mentioned, well, the Commerce Department report is where the factors are considered directly. The president's action is based on the report, but of course the president isn't necessarily tied to a specific action that is listed in the report, and I'm sure our government colleagues will make sure we're aware of that. The president, once he considers the factors in the report, he will make a decision. But the most important thing to me is the timing of this decision. If you go back to the statute and look at subsection C, there are very specific timelines established for presidential action and for the report. The Commerce Department is supposed to investigate, consult with the Defense Department and the other agencies, and issue a report that considers these factors within 270 days of the case getting started. Then the president has 90 days to consider those factors and decide whether he wants to take an action and what that action is. He then has 15 days to undertake the action. And I'm going to say, if you read the statute, it says the nature and duration of the action. It doesn't say many actions. It doesn't give him discretion to say, I can take actions now, and 6 months from now, and a year from now. It says the action. But the action can include tariffs, quotas. It can include an agreement with other countries. And in the statute, at the back end of C, if you read it carefully, if an agreement that is made is unsuccessful, then he is allowed to take other actions. The statute is clear on its face on when the president can take an action and when the president can take additional actions. And the additional actions occur when the agreement is not reached with other countries or it is he's unable to conclude an agreement successfully.
Mr. Nolan? Mr. Nolan? Judge Kaplan, sure. Go ahead then. I'll go after you.
In your brief, you discussed that Congress imposed a 180-day limit so that, quote, a national security threat be acted upon as quickly as possible. That's your brief.
Right.
So the question is, how can an interpretation of Section 232 that would require a new investigation by the Secretary before the President may modify the action taken be reconciled with Congress's desire for that the President act as quickly as possible
to face a national security threat.
All right, thank you, Your Honor. I think that does require that the President act as promptly as possible and expeditiously to remedy the threat. And the way we reach this is the Congress intent for the President to take the report, to take the concise action, and that action is the national security remedy. It is not a continuing authority to change the remedy unless the President goes back to the Commerce Department and either has a new report issued or a supplemental report issued that reevaluates. I think there's actually past administrations where this issue has come up, and I think in a Farrow-Vanadium or Farrow case, where the government actually said that if the President were to go back and get a supplemental report from the Commerce Department to reevaluate the threat, he can change the action at that point. But that's the predicate.
Mr. Nolan?
Yes.
Mr. Nolan, if the President takes an action such as a tariff, takes a 50% tariff, and then wants to stop or reduce the tariff, how do you think that works under your interpretation of the statute? Does he have to report?
I don't think the termination of an action is an action itself. It's a removal of an action.
What about the reduction of a tariff?
I think the President would likely have to go back and have that reviewed. However, that's not the
case, I know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so we're not arguing that
Judge Kelly,
I suspect that no one would argue enough.
Yes. Could you hold on 1 second? Let's see.
Yes.
We just have a noise going on here at the court. So, Steve, we're going to have to add a little time back. Could you ask them over there?
Yeah, they can hold
behind
on
us
for an hour.
They're drilling something. You would think that there was nobody here in New York except us, but apparently they managed to schedule the construction work on the day we would be here. So we'll give you back this time. I apologize.
I have no worries, Your Honor. I'm
at least you can't hear the drilling where you are, so that's good.
Well, but you could have heard the guys cutting my grass about
30 minutes. Right. And I once had a trial reduce a tariff, for example, and you had said, that's just not the question that we have here, basically. But
right.
I might have to get a report.
Yes, I agree. If you were to press it, I would say that technically you could say that you have to modify an action and you're taking a new action. I do not think removing it requires an action. It is an action because you're simply removing what had already been done.
Okay.
And so that would trigger it. But that's the question that stays up to date.
Mr. Nolan, I know this is you're going to say this is a hypothetical question, but imagine that you are the President of the United States, and you're dealing with the factual pattern here. What, in your view, would constitute an adequate justification under Section 232 to increase the tariff on
certain? Well, I put this into a factual determination, which I'm sure the court will be reluctant to get into, but if you were to ask me if imports from Turkey were to double after the 232 duties were put in place, or there was a massive increase, then the President would want to go back and say, I think there's an issue here, and if it were me, I'd say, Commerce Department, I want you to go back, I want you to evaluate where we are right now, and then come back to me and tell me what's going on. And then they would come back with a supplemental report, say, Your Honor, Mr. President, the duties from Turkey have not remitted, they've not gone down, they haven't done what we wanted them to do, you need to take further action. Now the President is authorized to move again. He can take another action, in my view, at that point. The problem here is the President didn't follow the procedure.
I have another question about the procedure. I think we can agree that the President did not go back, so we're only arguing about whether he had to. But there's another requirement in the statute that within 30 days of making a decision, the President has to report to Congress. And I was wondering if that happened here, and what's the purpose of that?
The purpose of that is to inform Congress of the action that was taken, so the Congress has the opportunity to disapprove of the action, if I'm right, Russell. I think I've got that right. And I'm fairly certain the President did notify Congress, because there was no, I do recall that there was a discussion about it, but no action was taken to disagree or disapprove of the President's decision here. Our friends at the Justice Department may have more information than I do, but that's my recollection.
Okay.
Counsel, what criteria should the court consider to determine whether a certain presidential action is too removed from national security interests to have a nexus to the purpose of the statute?
I think it is my view, our view, that if the President acts beyond what is informing his decision in the Commerce Department report, I keep coming back to when the Commerce Department issues its report, it identifies the nature and circumstances of national security threat. His authority gets triggered on the basis of that report. And if he stays within the confines of what that report says, even in a more liberalized interpretation of it, then the President may rely on that as the positive authority for the nexus for his national security position. If, however, the President doesn't stay within the confines of the report, then I think he's acted ultra vires beyond his authority, because his authority for the national security determination derives from that report. In this instance, the report said that steel from a large number of countries presented a national security threat. And the options it gave him was to put a tariff on all countries or put a larger tariff on a group of 12 countries, including Turkey, and quotas on the rest of the world.
But Mr. Nolan, he's not tied to those options, is he?
He's not tied to those options, but I do believe he's circumscribed in his authority to go very, very far beyond the confines of what the national security identified as. His options may not be limited, but his authority,
he could look at the report and say it's the cumulative effect, but I, in my wisdom, I'm going to pick the largest importer or exporter to the United States, and I'm going to impose the biggest tariff on that party. He could do that, couldn't he? He didn't have to do all of them.
He could do that in the initial decision process.
Yeah, in the initial decision process, right? But not a second time. So if he could do that, so he could have started with, for whatever reason, we're not gonna peel back the curtain, right? He could say, I'm just going after Turkey. If he did that initially, he could do that, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. He could do that. Okay.
Is it time for the equal protection?
Well, you might want to, you have about 6.5 minutes if you want to, did you want to move to equal protection due process?
Yeah. You also wanted to take over, we don't get the due process, I don't think any of those can queue up yet.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. I'm also appearing on behalf of Trans-Pacific to address the constitutional issues of equal protection and due process. So first, equal protection. The equal protection principle forbids arbitrary classification, but there is no rational relationship to a legitimate government purpose.
Mr. Zemel, I'm going to interrupt you. Yes. In the interest of time, because I want to get to one particular point of disagreement between you and the government. The government seems to say, look, you have to show that invidious intent to discriminate here. So what would you say to that? They cite Feeney in a bunch of cases, and they say, you have to point to the President intending to hurt importers from Turkey.
Well, I would respond in two ways. First of all, this is facial. This is not an instance where invidious discrimination needs to be shown. This is on the face of the proclamation that steel articles from Turkey are targeted for this particular tariff. And, of course, by law, importers are paying that tariff, not Turkey. So it's directed at, it's on its face directed right at the importers. Second of all, it's clear that the difference in treatment here is not merely not merely in spite of the fact that Trans-Pacific imports Turkish steel. But for the importation, the tariff would not be imposed.
Okay.
So, right, let's go of classification among similarly situated parties is established, we must demonstrate that there is no rational connection between the classification and a legitimate government purpose. But here, while safeguarding national security is important, there is no link between the differential tariff on Turkish steel and this purpose. And this court has already ruled that a general need to increase tariffs does not explain the duty on Turkish articles alone. The classification here is so attenuated from the purpose and divorced from factual context as to lack a rational basis. This court has also, we agree with the court's prior opinion on denying the government's motion to dismiss, that there is no possible, there's no offer, let alone possible justification in this case, and since then we feel the government has not offered anything new, any new justification or connection, rather, between the action and justification to support, or to defeat an equal protection claim. So, may I answer any questions you might have about equal protection?
You can move on to due process if you want.
Okay. So, the due process clause prohibits the government from depriving a person of property without due process of law. This requires identification of protected property interest and a lack of sufficient process for depriving a person of that interest. The first plaintiff has raised a protected interest. The plaintiff has a protected interest in its competitive and economic rights being respected in a manner that does not amount to the arbitrary administration of law. These rights are independently rooted, as the court notes in its question to the government, the concession to the government, in the harmonized tariff schedule and normal trade relations statute, which would, give importers...
Would you agree that, and you pose that question to the government, because it seems to me that the law requires that any right to be protected by due process needs to flow from some independent source. And so in searching for an independent source, we ask the government to respond to that. Do you have any other independent source? I mean, we mentioned that. I don't think you mentioned that in your brief. So what were you thinking? What was the independent source that you thought these rights flow from? That's question number one. And question number two is, what more process would you get than the statute already provides? Now, you may say we didn't get the process that the statute provides. That's a separate question. But does due process require more than the statute has already provided?
Well, yes, I'll take the second question. The minimum process that is due, of course, is the investigation and report, not non-public advice from the Secretary of Commerce. And plaintiff also has a legitimate interest in that, and not simply a unilateral expectation. But more so, plaintiff is entitled to a fair and honest process, and Federal Circuit is pointed to prejudgment or decision-making by an irrevocably closed mind as reasons that a fair and honest process may not be applied.
I was going to say, do you have something to point to show that there's an irrevocably closed mind here? I mean...
Well, I would come back to the...
That's a hard standard to meet. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yes, Your Honor. I would turn back to the evidence Mr. Nolan cited of the President's series of tweets and the letters that he wrote tying the action to diplomatic relations and threatening to destroy the Turkish economy. And that ties back to the quote in there. And that ties back to the issue with the pastor. So I think that goes to show that there was no decision-making that was related to the investigation and the report, that was related to something that rises to the level of a fair and honest process.
I don't know. Do we have to have a trial about that?
I think it's a very hard standard to meet, irrevocably closed mind. I'm not sure what cases you're thinking about, but I'm trying to think about the ones I remember, and I'm not sure that this is that. But maybe you want to point me to some authority about why we should be considering that.
I see some big problems if we have to try and figure out exactly what's in the President's mind. I have a hard time with that being the standard.
Well, we don't have to, Your Honor. We can point back to the tweets and letters by the President. They are very clear that the reason that he is imposing this tariff is not because of national security interests, but because of because of his desire, because of his calling Lira, Lira calling us the dollar, because of his, as Mr. Nolan mentioned, the issue in Syria. We don't have to get here.
You would say that's a violation of due process, separate and apart from any procedural problems that are already required by the statute and arguably not followed. That the unfairness of this process is what you're complaining about.
Exactly. This is fundamentally unfair, and it must be a fair and honest process in order to comport with the due process.
And you don't see any problem with us pulling back the curtain and looking into the president's motivation and fact-finding, even though cases seem to say we can't do that?
Well, the cases that say the court can't do that are go to our argument about the nexus. You can't pull back the president's fact-finding and motivation for purposes of the statute. For purposes of due process, the test is constitutional issues. The test is a little different.
Let me ask you this. Why would you say, you'll get a chance to deal with this on rebuttal after the government deals with it, why would you say that the combination of the MFN statute and the HTS give rise to due process? Typically, the due process claims, you're looking at things, you know, from law school, Matthews v. Eldridge, you're talking about the Goldberg v. Kelly, or Roth, you're looking at cases where 10-year job security is provided or welfare benefits are provided, food is provided. Those types of statutes that provide for the basic needs of individuals, why does MFN rise to the level of those statutes? Because I'm not sure it's clear that it does.
The trade regime was established, and these statutes were established to allow international trade to occur. We understand that there is no constitutional right to international trade, but once that trade is granted, once those trade rights are granted, we have a unilateral expectation that they will be respected.
Unless there's a national security problem.
Right, which goes back to the statute has to be followed. And, of course, as we said, the statute is the minimum level of process that is due.
Okay. Got questions? Good. Anything else?
No, I'll go reserve the remainder for about a while.
Thank you.
I have one question.
Judge Katzman has a question.
Going back to Judge Kelly's line of questioning, what is your home run case? What is your home run precedent on the due process argument?
I think our home run case is simply the aggregate of due process jurisprudence that's come up through the years. We talk about this being a protected interest, these competitive and economic rights, and those must be respected from an arbitrary administration of the law. I think that it's the aggregate of jurisprudence that gives us our home run.
And can you just sort of help me with the facts here? Okay, so the tariff is. The Turkey is not 25%, but 50%. What is the current tariff status for Turkey?
I believe the current status is 25%, Your Honor. It was lowered in 2019, I believe May 2019. But it is currently, it's currently at 25%. It's 25 to 50 to 25.
Right. So how do you... address the argument that the fact that the tariff was lowered is reflective of good faith in by the executive.
I'm sorry, I'm not sure I understand the question around good faith.
Well, insofar as you're making claims of invidious and intentional discrimination with respect to the equal protection argument. I'm just wondering whether the fact that the tariff was low
back to 25%, whether that somehow impacts your argument of invidious discrimination by the president?
No, I don't think so, Your Honor. The tariff was lowered back after much of the circumstances that are being permissible circumstances were abated. The pastor, for instance, was released. And again, later on during the Syria conflict, the president threatened to raise tariffs by back up to 50%. That never happened because the situation was also resolved. But I don't think that that represents good faith. It certainly doesn't represent good faith at the time that the tariffs were increased. And okay, I have no further questions at the moment. We're there for rebuttal.
Thank you. Mr. Ticini?
Good morning, Your Honor. This is Steve Ticini from the United States. Just a preliminary matter, Mr. O and I are also going to divide up the argument. I'll be handling the statutory and also priorities issues, and Mr. O will be handling the constitutional issues.
Okay.
I'd like to begin with the court's question, which is, can the court review the nexus of the presidential action to the statute? And the answer is absolutely no. Motion systems, the en banc Fed Circuit decision precludes any sort of nexus review. Now, in that case, motion systems claim that, quote, the president violated the terms of Section 421 by opting to protect national interests over domestic industry without evidentiary support. And motion systems thus accuses the president of acting beyond the scope of authority delegated to him under the statute. And that's exactly what the plaintiff is doing here. The plaintiff is saying that the president's fact-finding was somehow wrong, and because his fact-finding was allegedly wrong, he acted outside the scope of the statute. Any change to that standard of review is going to have to be addressed either by the Supreme Court or the Federal Circuit sitting en banc. And this is not new law. The Federal Circuit and motion system...
Can I ask something? In motion system, it was a very unfettered discretion. I asked a question earlier about the factors that shall be considered by Commerce and the president. So don't we have a statute where the discretion is not totally unfettered? It seems a little bit different from motion systems.
The statute here provides the president with at least as much discretion as the motion systems statute, which also provided standards. And if you look at 232D, the criteria that the non-exhaustive list of criteria is incredibly broad. But then you look at what the president does, and under subsection C, 1A2, if the president concurs with the findings of the Secretary of Commerce, he then determines the nature and duration of the action that, in the judgment of the president, must be taken to adjust the imports of the article and its derivatives.
But, Mr. Ticini, so just right there. So clearly, he has to do something that adjusts imports, right? So if he did something, if he required something outside of adjusting imports, if he required licensing from people who eventually use steel products in the United States, that would be outside the authority, right? That would be ultra vires. There are some things that could be ultra vires.
Right, and the independent gasoline case,
right.
The district court case in the 1980s is an example of that.
Right,
sort of
okay. So there is some ultra vires action that could happen here. So the statute does tell us something about...
Well, it does. The president's discretion is not unfettered. You can see that the president needs to adjust imports. That's very plain.
But he adjusts imports after getting a report, as Mr. Nolan points out. Right? So, and clearly if he didn't get the report, then that would be ultra-vires too. But what you're saying is, what the report says doesn't matter. Is that right? Once we have a report?
Well, report?
Go ahead.
To a very large degree. If the Commerce Department issues a report that says there's no harm to national security, then the plaintiffs would have a good alternative. If Commerce Department issues a report that says that the national security is threatened with impairment due to imports of an article, then the president has extremely wide discretion to adjust imports of that article.
Would he have discretion to adjust imports of another article? So if there was a report on steel, could he say, you know, I'm going after steel and aluminum?
That would be a different case.
Yes,
so long as aluminum is not a derivative of article of steel, because it's, you know.
That would be ultraviolet, right? If you went after
aluminum.
Aluminum.
Yeah, the report
was on steel or peanut butter, right?
If the report's on steel, yes. If the report's on peanut butter, then
okay.
Then the president's acting well within his authority.
Fair enough. So you know what my next question is going to be. If he can't touch aluminum when the report's about steel, how can he go after one set of importers alone when the report's about all of them? Why is that different from my first hypothetical? And I know it's a different case.
Right. And the reason, I mean, as the plaintiffs admitted, the president could have singled out Turkish imports at day, you know, basically at day 105, had he wanted to. He had the authority to do that. And if you look at subsection C, you know, C1A2, it's entirely left to the judgment of the president. And so Congress said in the judgment of the president when it enacted the statute. So it left that decision entirely to the president. And if you go back to Motion Systems relied very heavily on an almost century-old case called George S. Bush. And there the Supreme Court said that the president's exercise of his fact-finding authority and judgment is, quote, no more subject to judicial review than if Congress itself had exercised that judgment. Because in this case, as in the statute in George S. Bush, Congress delegated some of its authority to the president, including its discretion. So as Congress is constrained by the Constitution when it enacts laws, when there's a delegation to the president, that's the same constraint that Congress intended hold the president back, with the exception of the actual language of the statute.
You're proceeding in this case under the theory that this is a permissible modification. Is there any point that you see where a modification could be so large that you have to go back for a report? Do you see any possible modification that would require a report?
I'm sure that we could construct one that the plaintiffs would have a much better argument.
So the answer is no, not today.
But the answer is no. The answer is no, not today, and the answer is most likely no, and that the supervision would have to come from Congress. If you go back to the 30-day notice provision in the statute, the president needs to provide notice to Congress, and then if the Congress believes the president is exceeding what it believes to be the spirit of the delegation, then Congress cannot.
But in the 1988 amendments, wasn't Congress acting in response to inaction on behalf of the president in prior circumstances where there was a report issued and there was no action taken? And if that's the case, what would stop the president from getting a report from Congress and saying, this is the action that I'm taking, I'm thinking about it, and then doing exactly what the president had done before and kind of keep that sword hanging above everyone's head? That would totally eviscerate the 1988 amendments, no?
Well, Congress was well aware that this could happen when it enacted the 1988 amendments, and we, in in our briefs, we raised a number of cases during the motion for judgment stage for the first time regarding what we, directory versus mandatory time periods. And in 1986, the Supreme Court had issued Brock v. Pierce County, where the court talked about the Department of Labor audit of grant holders that was meant, the 120-day deadline in that statute was meant to spur action. It was not meant to prevent action taken after the 120-day period. And that action actually did have adverse effects to the grant holders. And 2 years before the 1988 amendments, the Supreme Court set forth that rule that that unless there are actual consequences written into the statute, these sorts of deadlines are meant to spur action. They're not meant to cut off the opportunity for action after the time has passed.
Don't you have a different situation where Congress has a certain area in which it operates, and it then decides to delegate to the president certain of that authority pursuant to specific requirements? It seems to me that there is a difference between the cases you cite and this kind of case where the president can only act pursuant to whatever authority Congress gives him, and if there are no limits, you have other problems. Isn't this a different situation than your labor case?
No, because any executive agency in cases, if you look at, say, the bread and butter dumping cases or customs classification decisions, all of those, in all of those cases, the agencies are acting under some sort of delegation of authority from Congress. Whether it's the dumping context, it's the Commerce Department that has the authority
to determine dumping rates. But that's the difference. Those are agencies. The president is not an agency, and a party who is affected by that can bring an action under the APA for failure to compel agency action unlawfully withheld. There's a whole different scheme for agencies. The president gets exempted from that scheme, but the president is acting on a delegation from Congress. So I think it might be different, as Judge Rustani suggests.
If anything, it would lead to more deference for presidential decision-making if you look at the governing cases. And Congress was well aware of all of those cases.
Actually, I think
Georgia Bush.
The more discretion the president has, the bigger problem there is on the other side. That is, if it's unfettered, then it may be an unconstitutional delegation. So you can't make discretion so big that it wipes out the requirements and the limitations that Congress set. Otherwise, you have to have a balance here. You end up on the other problem of excessive delegation. So I don't know that more discretion is the answer. Anyway. If that's a comment. If you got a answer to my comment, go right ahead.
Well, I'll put it in the question. It does do what Mr. Nolan suggested at the very beginning, which is it makes the procedure more important. And that is consistent in other cases as well, with when you give discretion to the president, then the procedure takes, we need to make sure we take the procedure very seriously. So by arguing for this discretion, aren't you kind of arguing against your position with respect to the procedure?
No, not at all, because when Congress enacted the 1988 amendments, and we're talking about timing here, it was well aware of the canons of statutory construction that were set forth by the Supreme Court only 2 years before. And ever since then, the Federal Circuit and the Supreme Court again and again have reinforced that position.
So is your
and
okay, sorry. Answer, then I have a question.
Well, what the plaintiffs are attempting to do is have the court engraft a consequence onto the temporal deadlines that would prevent the president from taking action to adjust import measures, the continuing implementation of import measures under 232.
Okay, so your only answer to the 1988, we had the, before 1988, the language was, the president shall take action and for such time as he deems necessary to adjust the imports. After that, they take out for such time, and you get the time limit. And your only answer to that is directory versus mandatory. Is that correct?
The answer to that is that Congress did not include any consequences in the statute that
okay.
needed it could
that
have
means
if it
what you're
to.
Saying to me is, yes, my only answer is directory versus mandatory. That's what your answer is.
Well, that plus the statute as a whole, which we argued in our brief regarding the word implement, could be looked at as either in the present or future tense, and a number of other cues that we set forth in our brief show that Congress intended there to be continuing implementation of the statute.
Mr. Cassini, can we go back for a moment to your conception of the definition of national security under Section 232? As you know, General Mattis's statement when he was Secretary of Defense was cited in the Budokan, that in AIIS back in March of 2019, he stated that U.S. military requirements for steel and aluminum only represent about 3% of U.S. production. So the argument, I suppose, is that national security is broader than national defense. It means the entire economy, in your view. Is that your view?
My view is that the subsection D sets forth what national security was intended to mean by Congress, and national defense alone is only a subset of that. So yes, our national infrastructure is important to our national security, even if it's not only used for the purposes of, you know, for military purposes.
And with respect to the 1852B2, requiring the president to submit to Congress a written statement of reasons why the president has decided to take action, is it your position that a conclusory statement by the president is sufficient to satisfy the requirements articulated in 1862B2?
Yes. If Congress has a problem with that, they can ask for more detail from the president. But it's up to the president to decide the scope of his reporting to Congress, and it's up to Congress to provide a framework for the president to follow in reporting to Congress. That's the two political branches communicating with each other.
Mr. Cassini, you're at about 8 minutes. I didn't know if you wanted to shift to Mr. O.
Yes, we'd like to shift to Mr. O. If the court has no further questions, thank you.
Mr. O?
Good morning, Your Honor. I'm here to address the constitutional issues. The first issue I'll address is the Equal Protection Clause claim. We think the fundamental footprint of any Equal Protection Clause claim is that there must be some type of purposeful discrimination. And I do want to make an important distinction. We're not talking about subjective intent. What Feeney said is based on the legislation itself or the state act itself, the court must infer empathy. And so that's an important hallmark of what a constitutionally based claim of discrimination is. Now, something can be evident on the face of the law, and I think an important kind of way of viewing it is in the class of one context, some municipalities pass laws that appear neutral on its face. For example, anyone that's 5'7" and 150 pounds can't live within this particular area within the town. And everyone knows that that's, you know, addressing Bob Miller. And so that's the quintessential classic class of one claim where the court can say, all right, on its face it's neutral, and we're not deriving any type of subjective intent, but we can infer the antipathy based on a plain reading of the legislation itself. So that's what we're talking about when we say there must be a purpose to the act that is...
We don't have to infer anything here, right? The president intended to single out importers from Turkey.
We respectfully disagree, Your Honor. I don't think the president meant, I don't think we can make the inference that the president intended to single out importers from Turkey. I think the best case that the plaintiffs can make is that the president had some antipathy towards Turkey. And that's, again, reading the evidence in the best possible light according to their characterization of the facts. But there's no mention of importers anywhere in the record. There's
no
reference to
importers. I understand what you just said. Say again what you think their best case is. I didn't hear the words.
Oh, so they refer to some possible action by the president because he had some antipathy towards Turkey, but that, I think, is distinguishable from any antipathy towards the importers themselves. The record doesn't show any indication of any...
Listen, what world are you in? Exports come from one side, imports are received on the other. Aren't they inextricably linked? Exports come from Turkey.
If
imports
you,
come into the United States.
If
from
you
Turkey.
Have antipathy towards Turkey, the only way you're going to affect it with imports is to work through importers from Turkey. That's it.
But that I think is the quintessential issue with the equal protection claim. If you're going to elevate it to the point of a constitutional question, I think what the case law makes clear is that the discriminatory effect can't be a collateral effect of what the legislation was intended to accomplish. And that's a quote, collateral effect. In this case, merely because it was a direct or even a foreseeable consequence of the president's action is not enough, it's not sufficient to indicate that that legislation was enacted with a discriminatory purpose under the
Constitution.
Why do
we have to have a discriminatory purpose? It's a tax.
Yes. This is Allegheny, right? This is just
Allegheny.
Like that case, Allegheny. There's a tax. It's isolating one class of taxpayer, and there's not a rational basis for it.
Well, Your Honor, I would point to how the Supreme Court has interpreted the Equal Protection Clause. In every case where the court has found a violation of the Equal Protection Clause and an insufficient justification to survive rational basis review, the court has always found that there is nothing more than a bare desire to harm a politically unpopular group.
Wrong.
So
Allegheny. It's a tax. You can't have a tax that for comparable people that's different. You have unless you have a rational basis. All you need is a rational basis. So you win or lose with a rational basis. That's a case.
Yeah,
Allegheny.
I'm,
it's a case.
I'm quoting Trump versus Hawaii Chief Justice Roberts' decision. But in every case, the Supreme Court has found an equal protection violation that did not survive rational basis review. It inferred nothing more than a bare desire to harm a politically unpopular group. And that accords with what Justice Roberts
said. Was that a tax case where Justice Roberts was speaking to us?
It was not, but he was referring to every single Supreme Court precedent in which the court found that the justification did not survive rational basis review. So, for example, you refer to cases like Romer versus Evans or Windsor or Claiborne. All those cases involve politically unpopular groups that the court can infer the antipathy based upon what the legislation was trying to accomplish. That's our only point.
Let me ask you about, what okay. about our MFN HTS question that we said?
Sure, Your Honor. So I think there are two points there, and I don't think that we can infer a legitimate expectation of a continued receipt of benefit based upon those two statutes. And our first point is statutory. The MFN statute was promulgated through the Trade Expansion Act under Section 251 of the Trade Expansion Act of 1962. It was promulgated at the exact same time as Section 232 of the Trade Expansion Act, and also referenced the fact that when we're talking about the most favored nations provision, it's not going to abridge any of the rights promulgated under that part of the subchapter. So we think statutes have to be read together. What the most favored nations statute recognizes is there's an idea of normalized trade relations, but we're not abridging executive authority to take acts in the face of risks to national security.
Well, you're not abridging it, but it, all it's saying is that if this creates a right, that you're entitled to due process, right? It doesn't mean that the president can't do something, but he has to comply with due process.
Well, the important point is that when we're reading the statutes together, the critical question is whether you're reading all these statutes in congruence and whether they confer a legitimately expected continued receipt of benefit. And in trade sphere, it just wouldn't make sense because legitimate claims of entitlement to benefits that are subject to lawful change don't qualify as
I'm going to have to stop you there. So yes, Congress can change a tariff. But the provisions for MFN, or normal trade relations as we now call it, basically just say, listen, unless you have another statutory authority, say for example an anti-dumping statute, right? You could have a different tariff rate because you have anti-dumping or countervailing duties. But if you're not in that basket, then you're going to have no less favorable treatment than our other trading partners. You can rely upon that. And likewise with the HTS. If you are a widget under a certain classification, you can expect that rate. Of course, if you're classified as something else, you might get another rate because the law provides that. And likewise, if you are subject to a 232 action, you might have your rate changed, but not without due process. I think that's all the argument is saying. So why isn't MFN and the HTS the very same as the expectory rates, the rates you would expect or the treatment you would expect under some other statute, such as welfare rights or housing or something like that?
So any time the court has done the analysis for the legitimate expectation of the continued receipt of benefit, I think courts have been very careful about analyzing what arena we're talking about. So just so you're right, like in the arena of welfare benefits or in the arena of Social Security benefits or a 10-year secure job, courts have been careful to say, well, that rises to the level of being worthy of a protected interest because if that right is removed from you, it almost amounts to a taking. And I'm quoting Global Industries here, where it's like the government has conferred something upon you such that you can legitimately expect that right to continue with due process. But in the case of a duty rate, we think the case law has been abundantly clear. The trajectory of the case law for 90 years has said, well, when you're in the arena of trade, you're not guaranteed a duty rate. You're not guaranteed a classification. You don't have some interest in some future business transaction. That's the American Association for Exporters. You don't have a right not to be affected by executive action. That's GILDA. You don't even have a cognizable interest in international trade at all. In this arena, it is hard to say that someone believed that they would have a legitimately expected continued right of benefit, where for the past 90 years, courts have made abundantly clear you can't really rely on that type of guarantee, particularly in light of Section 232, which says that the president has this broad, powerful, muscular, decisive authority to take actions in the area arena of national security.
I'm not
and
sure
Section 232.
What you're saying there, okay, if Congress or the state or whoever is giving you your welfare benefit changes the law and doesn't give it to you, then fine, you no longer have an expectation. If you have a statute that gives you a certain rate and you have an expectation in that rate until Congress or the state or whoever takes it away, I don't see the difference. You have an expectation as long as there's a statute out there that gives you an expectation. But it can be changed.
Well,
and it can be changed in either arena, can't it?
So a type of case might be Zucker versus the United States, because that case involved COLA adjustments to a retirement annuity. And what the court said is, you know, your cost of living adjustment, that's just going to change based upon how the regime is structured. So you can't have a legitimate claim of entitlement. It's something that's subject to lawful change. But it's important there because the court said that's not a property interest. So that's the first problem. That's the threshold showing. It's not a property interest because you know that's going to change. It's the same in the arena of a duty rate where you know it's going to change, where the backdrop of the case law says you don't have any of these guaranteed rights in the duty rate, Norwegian nitrogen or classic time. You don't have the right to a classification. You don't have a cognizable interest in the trade arena.
I see our time is up. Yeah. I just want to see if Judge Kaplan has a question.
Just one quick question. Going back to page 32 of your the government's brief, it's on equal protection and intent issue. You quote Feeney, you say, in other words, Feeney resounds showing that absent proof of discriminatory intent toward the claimant, there is no equal protection violation. And then your next paragraph says, unable to make this threshold showing, Trans-Pacific, the sentence continues. Why can't we consider the statements by the president in his tweets? And so if you look, Trans-Pacific is asking us to look at those statements as evidence of discriminatory intent.
So I think the important distinction that I was trying to make before is it's not really a subjective intent inquiry. It's whether there's a discriminatory purpose behind the legislation. So if you read Beach Communications, what that case signifies is that there's no requirement that a state actor specify any intent or rationale in the legislation or the act itself. It's merely whether one can construe a reasonably conceivable basis for the state action itself. And so that's where Beach Communications comes in, where it's under a rational basis review, we're not thinking about what's stated or what was subjectively intended, but whether we can think of a reason why the executive in this case would take this specific action. So that's where the inquiry is.
Post hoc rationalizations, in your view, are permissible?
According to Beach Communications, it's any reasonably conceivable basis, Your Honor. So Justice Thomas, when he wrote that decision, said, you know, we're not in the sphere of trying to figure out what was subjectively in the mind of the president, but if it's reasonable and we can think of it, then that should survive rational basis review. And he expressly jettisoned this notion that, you know, the president couldn't take piecemeal or incremental actions when furthering his stated interest or a stated interest.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you,
Mr. Nolan, Mr. Semmel?
Yes, we'll change the question, but I'll take a couple of minutes and then Doug Ruff will talk to you in a minute. I just want to pick up where we left off for a second. But I want us to take us back why we're here in the first place. Trans-Pacific is an importer of steel from various countries, including Turkey. Trans-Pacific had ships on the block when the president on a Friday afternoon decided that he didn't like Turkey and imposed 50% duty, 25% more than anybody else the next Monday. The ship arrived the next day. Guess what happened? They owed several $1 million in duties, which they didn't owe Thursday when the ship was on the water. Now, the question on our mind is there a due process right or expectation when you're subject to MFN treatment that over the weekend your duties go from 25% to 50% unannounced and you have no opportunity to do anything about it?
Couldn't Congress do that to you?
Congress could do that, but there would have been a bill, there would have been debate, there would have been deliberation of it, it would have taken time and there would have been a...
Well, they do things in the middle of the night. Congress can change the statute in the middle of the night, your boat leaves, and you're in the same mess.
I suppose. The next time I see Congress do something in the middle of the night, you'll let me know, Your Honor.
But you can't say that you would get more process than it's already in the statute. Why is this an independent claim? I mean, you may say, well, I didn't get the process I had in the statute, but what process would you like?
I think we would like the process that is in the statute.
Okay.
I think that the president is going to make basically the equivalent of a taking, because a 50% duty is basically precocious for most people. That at the very least, the president should be required to go back, get some support from the Commerce Department that tells him, yes, indeed, you need to do that.
Okay, so you want the process in the statute.
Okay. The only other thing I would want to raise is this concept of directory versus mandatory. In my mind, there is nothing directory about this statute. It says quite plainly that the president shall implement an action no later than 15 days, that he will take action no later than 90 days after a full decision, that he will state the nature and duration of the action.
Mr. Ticini is actually correct that there are cases out there about agencies that have statutes that sound very much like you shall do this, and then the statute, and then we find out, well, you shall do it, but if there's no consequence for not doing it, it's only directory. So I'm not sure shall gets you anywhere. I don't see how it does in light of those cases.
Oh, I think, Your Honor, that the circumstances of this statute and the way the Congress has amended the statute and intentionally imposed specific timing requirements on the President does distinguish it to that extent. It is plainly laid out. The Congress thought about this. It debated it, and it actually increased the brakes on the President's discretion with intention.
You're saying we should read into the statute a consequence, and the consequence is you can't do it.
Yes, and the consequence, I mean, the President, it's not that high a hurdle for the President to go back to the Commerce Department and get another report. It's just not that difficult to me. Following the procedures
There is time. There is time. It takes a few months, right? It doesn't happen overnight. Commerce has time to do this. So that's going to delay any change.
And the President waited for what? 6 months or 8 months to put this action in place against Turkey? You know, we could debate the timing requirement, but I think it's not an unfair requirement that the President be required to fall and act within the statutory requirements. That's the way it's laid out. If the Congress doesn't like what it's done, it can go back and repeal it or change it. But it put those breaks in for a purpose.
Okay.
Russell, do you want to take over a minute?
Sure. Thank you. First, before I would like to just go back to the court's opinion on the motion to dismiss. Again, I think it's important to put that front and center and show that the court understood that the government offered no rationale and there was no possible rationale that satisfied equal protection. The court hasn't heard anything new here that could possibly change its mind. And the court's also correct that we don't need to infer antipathy or purpose here, because who else is being harmed by this action? Only one group, the importers from Turkey. They are the ones paying the tariff by law. This is not collateral damage. This is the damage that the President is causing in order to further whatever objective he's intending to further. The government mentioned the Cleveland case.
Importers from Turkey, could nothing would stop them from importing from somewhere else, right? I could be an importer, I could just switch who I purchase from, right?
Well, that's the right line, but that doesn't defeat the equal protection claim. The harm is there, and having to change one's business is still the result of a violation of equal protection rights.
I thought your argument would have been that, hey, remember the boat. We already bought the stuff.
Yeah.
And we have a contract with the Turkish exporters. Isn't that your answer?
That was going to be the second part of the answer, Your Honor, yes. We can change the business in the future, but for now the harm is being done. The harm has been done.
I think we're out of time.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for
having
us.
Thank you very much.
You gave Mr. Cassini time.
Yeah, we should give Mr. Cassini. We'll give you another couple of minutes.
I hope not to use it, but okay. Thank you. I want to return to regarding authority, one thing that the court said. And yes, Congress could enact a statute, and the President could sign it overnight, raising the rate of duty on a particular product from 25 to 50%. Congress has that authority. In this case, Congress delegated that authority within certain constraints to the President. And the court is bound by the George S. Bush case, where the Supreme Court made abundantly clear that the President had basically the same power as if Congress had enacted the duty. And I'll turn the rest over to
Mr. Cassini. Can I ask you a question going back to directory and mandatory?
Yes.
So You're right. You know, directory mandatory, there are many cases where courts have said, unless there's a consequence built into the statute, it's just directory. Even though it says shall all over the place, it's just directory. And we've seen that in our area of work, in the trade and customs area. But in those cases, what you typically have is an enabling act that empowers the agency generally to do lots of things. And then there's a portion of the statute that says, and by the way, do this in a timely fashion. Why isn't that different from this case where the power to act at all flows from the statute, right? You don't, the president does not have any power to act in this field, because it's Congress's field, unless he complies with these provisions, and these provisions have timelines. So isn't that fundamentally different from where we normally see the mandatory directory debate?
That, because it's the president as opposed to an agency, that is the only difference. But
well, it's also where the power flows from. The power flows from the part of the statute that has the time limits in it.
Well, if you look at, say, the Commerce Department, the anti-dumping duty context, its power also flows from the anti-dumping duty law that has a number of time constraints as well with respect to, say, administrative reviews or record or investigations. And those likewise are directory and not mandatory. So I don't believe this is a very important distinction for and a basis for limiting the president's discretion under a statute that is a lawful delegation to the president.
Okay. Are you switching to Mr. O now?
I'll be very brief, Your Honor. The first thing I want to say is that the notion of a discriminatory purpose to find a finding of an equal protection violation has been the bedrock of the law. Every Supreme Court case that has found a violation of rational basis review under the Equal Protection Clause.
You never answered my question about Allegheny. There's nowhere in Allegheny it says anything about motivations. They cited that case. It has to do with a tax. You know the case? They cited it.
It doesn't spring to mind off the top of my head,
right,
Your Honor, so I apologize for that.
It shouldn't have been a surprise. They did cite it. All right.
But again, the notion of a discriminatory purpose is the bedrock of equal protection law. The second thing, and the second element of that test is, plaintiff's counsel has said there's no possible rationale for the justification, but the president listed what his rationale was on the face of the order itself, where he said, in light of national security interests, he wanted to increase domestic capacity utilization, and he believed that imposing tariffs on Turkey would be a significant step toward achieving that result. Under Beach Communications, that should be sufficient under the law. The idea, now we can agree or disagree on whether that's the perfect fit, but that's not appropriate in the rational basis review context. On the due process clause claim, we believe that the property interest evinced here doesn't rise to the level worthy of constitutional consideration. It's not the same as a welfare benefit or a Social Security benefit, where the government is actually conferring something to specific individuals and saying, this is yours, and under Gilda Industries, the court has said, that type of claim that's deprived amounts to a taking without due process of law. Here, the government is not taking, it's merely changing a duty rate. There are no further questions. We respectfully request that the court find there are no constitutional violations under the Proclamation 9772.
Judge Katzmann, any other questions?
No, thank you.
Okay. Well, thank you all for your participation and your briefs, and the matter is submitted, and we are adjourned. Have a good day.
All right.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right.